I'm Ken MacLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind. Mind training and self-cherishing.
Mind training is one of these typical practices that emerged well on in the development of Buddhism in India. It's actually not clear that it developed in India, because Atisha journeyed to supposedly to Sumatra. Sometimes I think it was Sri Lanka, but traditionally it's regarded as Sumatra, to receive these teachings from a person called Dharmakirti. There's some reference made to the idea of exchanging oneself for others in Shantideva's Bodhicharavatara, which is about 200 or 300 CE. But Atisha was in the 11th century. He came to Tibet in 1042. So his journey to Sumatra was probably around 1000. So this is 1500 years after Buddha lived. So Buddhism in India was very, very well developed, mature, probably baroque and overripe, really. What happens when you have a tradition of practice which has been around this long is that many, many teachings become compressed and into a single practice. And it's quite extraordinary. And many, many of the Tibetan practices are like this. There are so many elements, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here. And when you know the history of Buddhism, you look at these practices and you go, wow, they've got so many different elements. They're so rich. Taking sending is a very, very simple practice, has a great deal of richness to it. So in a certain sense, it partakes a bit of all three of these categories of meditation that I've just described. It's almost simple enough to be used as a way of practicing presence, so that's certainly not its main use. In a certain way, it does transform energy, too. But its principal point is as a purification practice. It gets stuff that is in the way of being present. It takes it apart. And a very specific thing that it takes apart is self-cherishing. Now, when I translated this book back in the 80s, the standard translation for the Tibetan term Dogzin was ego-clinging. I think I used that term in there. I would never use that now because it's very problematic. The ego that is talked about in Buddhism has nothing to do with the ego that is talked about in psychoanalytic psychology. They're two completely different beasts. And I heard a very witty commentary on the use of self in Western psychology, which the psychologists who were at this really didn't like, because he basically made it clear that the use of the term self had so many different meanings in Western psychology, you had no idea what anybody was talking about. He went through 9 different ones, starting it off with asking his dog, "What is your true self?" And the dog looked at him very attentively, so I figured he was getting somewhere. So I looked at the dog again, and he went, "What is your true self?" And the dog looked at him even more intently. I thought, I'm really going to get there. So he tried a third time. Says, tell me your true self. And the dog went, ruff, ruff, and wagged his tail and went off to his bowl, expecting dinner. I thought it was a perfect opening to the to his talk, because that was the dog's true self. So we have there's a difference between, or we make a distinction between attachment to a sense of self, or holding to a sense of self, and cherishing the sense of self. Holding to the sense of self is a very, very deeply habituated pattern that basically takes consciousness or awareness as a thing and makes it into a subject so that everything else becomes an object. The I, other. It's very unfortunate because once we do that, then the world becomes consciousless. There isn't any, or consciousnessless. Isn't English a horrible language? It becomes completely devoid of conscious because we've appropriated it all for ourselves. But that basic way of experiencing the world is what is meant by holding a sense of self. Cherishing is to take that sense of self is the center of the universe, which is basically how we approach life. And I am the most important thing. And all you have to do is drive around LA for a while, particularly avoiding people with Mercedes or BMWs, and you really understand they're the center of the world. But that's when we take this sense of self and we build up a whole life around protecting it and taking care of it. This is what I mean about making us the center of the world. And what we're making the center of the world doesn't actually exist. So obviously, we introduce a fairly serious imbalance into the world of experience, and our efforts to maintain that imbalance is what we experience as suffering. And becomes more and more of a struggle. The word dukkha in Sanskrit is usually translated by English term suffering. It could actually be translated by the English term struggle. Because, and in some ways that's a little more accurate. Because it refers to the reaction from the, you know, the mild sense of dissatisfaction to the reaction to extreme torture and the mental, physical, or emotional anguish. it's all of that is dukkha or suffering. So, how mind training in all of its forms works, unlike cultivating attention, in which you do something repetitive over and over again, and whenever you get distracted, you come back and do it some more, and you actually build up attention in this way. What you do in mind training is you adopt a perspective. You instill a way of regarding the world of our experience, which is contrary to the way that certain habituated patterns have led us to observe the world or regard the world. And by adopting this, the perspective of mind training, you generate friction between the habituated way and the adopted way. And when there's enough friction, well, you rub two sticks together hard enough, then they eventually both burst into flame, and now you can be present. So this, in some respects, makes mind training, in any of its forms, a very challenging practice. Now, one of the Theravadin forms of mind training, of course, and which is used in the Tibetan tradition well, is just cultivation of impermanence, because our conditioning is such that we believe that we're going to live forever. There's a writer, William Saroyan or something, who said, we all know we're going to die, but none of us, I never thought this was actually going to happen to me. There's a woman who lives at the age of 96, and she had never been ill in her life. And finally her body started to give out, and she went, this isn't meant to be happening. And we really carry these attitudes. But the fact is, none of us are going to survive life. It's deadly. And so cultivating that understanding that we're actually going to die is a form of mind training. You're instilling and training a certain attitude which conflicts with the way that we ordinarily regard our lives. In the context of the Mahayana mind training, one's using this to develop compassion very explicitly. And compassion is really about being present, being able to be present with the suffering of others, which means we also have to be able to be present with whatever we ourselves are experiencing. And this just flies in the face of this ego-cherishing attitude that I mentioned, or self-cherishing attitude that I mentioned earlier, which seeks to protect the sense of self and to protect its status in our world of experience. So that's where the friction starts. So this is going to be our focus for the next few days. The text for this is The Great Path of Awakening, 1972, Kala Rinpoche. I'd come to Vancouver with Kala Rinpoche, and he had set up a center there, which is his first center in North America. And before he left for the airport to return to India, he handed me a text, handwritten, on this wonderfully thick Bhutanese paper. And he said, this may be helpful to you. So, my Tibetan was very, very minimal in those days. I mean, I could just translate for Rinpoche without having to look up every word in the dictionary. And a few months later, the teacher that Rinpoche had left behind said, why don't you get that text? And I think I should teach it. And because he knew what the text was. And it was the Mind Training in 7 points by or Jangun Kontrol's commentary, who's a 19th century teacher, commentary on Mind Training in 7 points, which was written in the 12th, 13th century, somewhere around there. So he got the text, and he taught it, and I translated as best I could. And then a bunch of people said, this is great, you got to translate this into English. And I said, I can't do that, I don't know Tibetan well enough. But they just kept insisting, so I did my best. And there was it's written, parts of the text are extremely colloquial, so it's very difficult to figure out what's really going on. And then I completed the translation, and I think it was in 1974, Trungpa Rinpoche was visiting Vancouver. I gave him a copy of the translation and as a gift, and I got word the next day. He said, could you please make him a copy of the Tibetan? He wants this. And that's when he started teaching the text at seminary. I retranslated this in the mid-80s when I was requested to do so for a French translation, or I did that actually in the early 80s when I was in retreat. And then when I came to Los Angeles, I took that translation and revised it into this English translation, which Shambhala published in 87. It's a slim book, but it's everything you need to know. And there's a great deal in it. So my intention over the next few days is actually to work through this book. This particular edition, which is the most recent one from Shambhala, they said they were republishing it, and I said, would you allow me to revise my translations, at least of the root text? And they said, sure, you can do that. So does anybody have the old copy here? Yeah. This was the original version published by Shambhala. You'll find that the root text in these two is not the same. And so that's why I'm going into this, so you understand. Well, it says this in here and this in here. Well, this is the right one. Thanks. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Now, I'm not going to go into the practice of taking and sending this evening. What I want you to do tomorrow morning is just to take the opportunity, just as we did this evening, to sit and let your mind and heart settle. Is there anybody here who doesn't know how to do that? I'll just review very quickly the way we approach it. That's breath. This is attention. You place the attention on the breath. How you do that is very simple. You know, you sit straight and breathe out slightly intentionally. And you find you just become aware of the breath. So you've placed your attention in the experience of breathing. And then you rest there, see? And then the in-breath starts, and the out-breath takes place. You just rest in the experience of breathing. That's all there is to it. There's only one small problem. That's what happens. The attention falls off the breath. Now, usually when the attention falls off the breath, we don't know about it. Then we have this revelation that we're no longer meditating on the breath. And then we go, oh, you stupid so-and-so, you should be meditating on the breath, and you know, you just can't do anything, etc. And we go into this big thing, which really doesn't help meditation practice at all. The best thing is to, oh, and just put the attention back on the breath. And you rest there. It falls off again. There's a moment of recognition. Put it back. Now, a lot of people think that meditation practice consists of holding the attention on the breath, concentrating, so forth. That's what you do to oranges to make orange juice. I found that effort to try to hold attention on the breath quite counterproductive, particularly in our setting. What I have found works very well for people is this idea of just returning over and over again. We just keep coming back over and over again and resting. And gradually you'll find that you rest longer and longer in the breath. But the important thing is that recognition, and as soon as that recognition, you return to the breath. And you just keep doing that. So that's the practice that I want you to do tomorrow morning. Some of you have your own meditation practices, and such as death and impermanence or four immeasurables or various other things that you're working on. We have several half-hour periods during the day. I want you to take one of those half-hour periods and do your regular practice so you don't lose connection with that. The rest of the time, I want you to be following the meditation instruction that I'll be laying out in the course of the retreat. But for our morning sitting tomorrow morning, just take the time, just come here, let your breath settle, or let your attention settle in your breath, and that'll be fine. One small point, in Buddhism we talk about mind all the time. But it's very, very important to remember that the word for mind in Sanskrit, citta in this case, and in Tibetan, sem, can in many, many contexts be translated just as well by the word heart. And so you might think about meditation as feel the breath with your heart. It has a very different feel to, you know, put the mind on the breath, doesn't it? But they actually mean the same thing. So feel the breath with the heart. But you might try that, just approaching your meditation practice tomorrow.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.